everybody. This is David Banner. This is chapter one of my book, Frame Shifting. Hopefully you've already listened to the preface. This chapter is called Ego and the Illusion of Separateness. Well, if you listen to my other podcast, you already know about duality, which means that we live in a world of opposites. This probably happened a long, long time ago before recorded time. But the idea is that your ego, which is a fictitional self made up by the mind, likes certain things and doesn't like certain things, values certain things and doesn't value certain things. So it's a play of opposites in duality. And apparently, before we dropped into this separated state that we now find ourselves in, we were one with everything, including all sentient life. So we apparently could communicate with animals and with plants. We had sort of a paradise on earth. Now, we don't know why, but we made some decisions as humans to see if we could go it alone without a connection to the divine. In other words, we wanted to see if we could make the world run the way we wanted to run with our egos, which are these fictitious mind-made entities. They're not real, but they're real enough, and they cause us enormous problems. So everybody has an ego, and it's a false self that we made up. Okay, so that's where you begin with this idea of the ego. Now, the ego looks like it's separate from everybody else and everything else. And this is the illusion of separateness because, in fact, we're still part of the whole. We're still connected to oneness. But we don't see it that way because we look like we have separate bodies. And it looks like we're separate from all other life forms. And it looks like we're separate from God. None of which is true. However, that's the way it looks. So we could call this the illusion of separateness. Again, it's not real, but it's real to our minds, and we act as though it were real. Therein lies the problem. How did we fall out of the state of oneness? Nobody knows. Could be that we, back in those days, decided to try to go it alone without God's help, without being connected to the whole and to divinity. So maybe it was an experiment. The other thing that could have happened is we decided to sink into our creation, meaning we decided to allow the so-called external world, the objective world, to influence us instead of us creating it, which is in fact what we do. Anyway, we don't exactly know what happened. Maybe we decided we don't need God to run things. We don't know what happened, but now we live in a collective reality that assumes our separate nature is real and that our job on planet Earth is to struggle and survive in an essentially hostile universe. This separate identity is what has been called the ego. As I said before, it's a false identity, and we literally made it up to confirm our belief in separateness from the wholeness that is intrinsic to life itself. So if the true reality is actually an expression of God force in its omniscience and omnipotence, what is called oneness in most spiritual traditions, then the reality we experience from the ego identity must literally be a waking dream, or you could call it a nightmare. If this is true, the only difference between our dream state at night and the daily dream we experience as reality is the laws governing each state. In the nightly dream, we can fly, travel to other worlds, etc., and you wake up in the morning effectively unchanged. In the daily reality, we have three-dimensional laws, which means if you walk off a building 30, 40 feet high, you'll die. So, a little bit more about the ego. Eckhart Tolle wrote this book called The Power of Now. And there, in his preface, he says he had a suicidal moment. And he said to himself, I can't live with myself any longer. This was the thought that kept repeating itself in my mind. And then suddenly, I became aware of what a peculiar thought it was. Am I one or two? If I cannot live with myself, there must be two of me, I and the self I cannot live with. Maybe, I thought, only one of them was real. Turns out he was right. The observer, the one who watches the fear-based ego response, is the true identity. And the small self, the false ego identity, is a self one cannot live with. And only one of them is real. The problem is that we in the egoic state think our reality we experience is real. It's only real in the dream state, the waking dream, as it's called. So we can see that our ego-based sense of self and its dream state has cost us dearly in terms of happiness and personal security. If it's true, as psychologists tell us, that we create our own realities from the software in our mind, the beliefs, attitudes, and values that we hold to be true, then we can see that our reality is just an outpicturing of deeply held beliefs, the most central one of which is the aforementioned separateness. We believe that we're separate. So we literally project on the screen of our consciousness a reality that conforms to what we believe, what we expect to happen, and what we assume to be true. One of the common denominators of the egoic experience is a sense of personal insecurity. And this makes sense if you think about it. If we pretend to be gods without any connection to the larger cosmic reality, then that is a recipe for insecurity. We're not connected by choice to the energy that literally runs the cosmos and determines the rhythms that govern life's movement in its creative cycles. The seasons, day and night, etc. Acting from the ego reality creates havoc because our actions conflict with the design of life as it is unfolding. We cannot see from the egoic frame the impact of our actions and thoughts on the larger world. No wonder we see a dangerous world out there. So, with this small sense of self, the ego identity, we naturally are afraid. And we then project this fear out into the so-called real world. This is a mind-made world. In other words, what it looks like out there through your senses is made up by your mind. We live in a conceptual world. It means our minds, almost instantaneously, label everything we see, hear, touch, taste, or smell with concepts based on the past. Let me give you an example. I used to do this with my students. I would hold up a pen in front of them and I'd ask them, what is this? And they'd all go, well, it's a pen. But what is it really? Quantum physicists tell us that it's an energy pattern or vibration, a quantum soup. We call it a pen because we've learned to label things that look like that as pens. So what we're actually seeing when we see the quote pen is a projection from the past, where we learn to call things that look like this a pen. If we were truly in the present moment, we would see an energy pattern of vibratory reality. However, since we are conditioned to label things and then think we know what they are, we see the dead past. One place this hurts us is in human relationships. When we see a friend or a partner, we look at them and think we know them. What we know are our concepts about them based on experiences in the past, so we can't effectively see who they are. We don't experience what there is to be experienced out there, Our minds quickly label things, and this effectively takes us out of the present moment. We're dominated by our minds. Eckhart Tolle said, we don't use our minds use us. Let me give you an example. One morning I got up early and walked downstairs in our home, looked out the kitchen window, and was struck by the beauty of the morning. It just, awe is what I felt. Awe. It was just amazing. Then I immediately said, oh, what a beautiful sunrise, which is a concept. This takes the aliveness out of the experience, so what you're left with is a pale imitation. I did this one morning, and when I said, oh, what a beautiful sunrise, it dimmed. I noticed that it noticeably dimmed in its awesomeness. Oh, so an amazing feeling that I had just became another concept in the mind. We live in a mental prison. Our minds tell us what to like, what to dislike, what to love, what to hate, what to value, and what to discard. This is really frightening if you consider the implications of this. If we use this small sense of self, the ego, as our identity, we think that who we are is our minds with its beliefs, opinions, concepts, expectations, values, and attitudes. Plus, we compound the problem by depending upon the external environment to make us happy. The external environment is composed of forms, objects, people, situations, and these are all transient. Have you noticed that one of the laws of life is change? Forms always change. They decay and they die eventually. So we're basing our sense of self on the most transient of things. No wonder we feel insecure all the time. Who we really are is eternal spirit, the animating force that governs the entire universe and beyond. By choosing this small identity, the ego, we're basically assuring that our lives will be full of conflict, resistance, and judgment. Not a recipe for happiness, is it? But through social conditioning, the media, our parents, and other forces, we are deeply convinced that life is just a fickle series of situations that we need to manipulate, plan, and persuade others so that we can get our needs satisfied. But our needs are ego-based. They can never be fully satisfied because the ego loves conflict and it resists what is in its quest to get what it needs from the external world. Eckhart Tolle talks about the existence of a pain body, which is the collective experience of a person in ego identity. It's full of pain. And this is down through the years, we've all contributed to a collective pain body, which we tap into also. So we're hardly ever satisfied with the way things are. The title of the other book with my podcast is Loving What Is. And that is the only way you're going to be satisfied, because you attracted to you what is based on the software in your mind. It is drawn to you by you in the ego identity. So the thing to do is accept it. Actually love it, because it can help you get clear of the egoic identity. One way to understand all this is through the Enneagram. The Enneagram is a tool which I'm going to describe fuller in this book, but it's a very old, probably 2,000 or 3,000 year old personality typology. It didn't start out as a personality typology. It started out as just 9 different ways that the egoic identity is organized. So there are 9 types. And each one of them is a type of ego. It all starts at type 9, which is called the peacemaker. Type 1, called the perfectionist. Type 2, called the helper or giver. Type 3 is called the performer or the achiever. Type 4 is called the tragic romantic. Type 5 is called the observer. Type 6 is called the loyal skeptic. Type 7, which is my type, is called the epicure. Type 8 is called the boss or the challenger. So one of these nine types is your home base. Now, the interesting thing about the Enneagram is we tend to visit all the types. This is one of my teachers told me. But we live in one of them. So the helpful thing is to understand where your home base is. Which of those nine types accurately describes the way you view the world through the lens of your ego? Okay? So one of the first things you have to do is identify which type is yours. There are ways to do this. There's several tests online. You can get a test from the Enneagram Institute or a test from the narrative tradition of the Enneagram. Both of these are online. They cost $10, I think. But that's one way to discover what your type might be. Now, you might not be able to discover it with the test. You might need somebody like myself, who's a teacher of the Enneagram, to interpret the test and help you discover what your actual type is. We'll go into this in great detail as we go through this book. But for right now, I just want to tell you that these nine types are all egoic archetypes. Now, what's the Enneagram good for? It's good for self-observation. It's good to look at the way you get stuck. Because each of these types has a positive and a negative aspect. So you will want to observe yourself doing your type, because right now it's unconscious. You're just acting like a robot based on the structure of your type. And once you learn what your type is, you can begin to watch yourself do the type. Let me give an example. I'm a type 7. Type 7s, the epicure, like to try everything. So what happens to the epicure is, about halfway through any project, they tend to get bored and they tend to look for something interesting to do, to stop doing what they're doing. Well, I know that because I know the Enneagram. So instead of stopping, which is what the Enneagram type wants me to do, I just keep going and finish the thing. Like I finished this book, Frame Shifting. I finished the next book, Loving It All. So you just make yourself do what your type doesn't want you to do, and you bust yourself. So this is the beauty of it. Okay, there are lots of other things we can say about this, but as I say, we'll move through it rather quickly. The key, though, is to remember who you are. Once the small, fear-based ego takes over, you can be convinced that this is who you are, even with all the evidence you have of the presence of a greater spiritual self. You need to catch the ego before it takes hold, and that's why the Enneagram is useful, because you can actually start to watch yourself do your unconscious egoic type. This is how I had a frame-shifting experience a while back. This really got into my ego self. I was driving north on a freeway in Chicago, rushing to meet my son for an appointment at the optometrist. I was speeding, and a cop pulled me over. I was going 62 in a 55 zone, so he gave me a warning. As I walked back to my car, my mind went to how late I was, and I totally missed the car that was swerving into me. The car hit my right ankle, tore off the driver's door, and propelled me over the hood and onto the pavement, staring at the grill of my car. I literally could have been killed. This is one of the many instances where my guardian angels helped me out, apparently. Anyway, the cop was still there and saw the whole thing. He called an ambulance and covered me up with a blanket to prevent shock. I saw my ankle, which was broken in several places. It was twisted 90 degrees. This is kind of funny. It wasn't at the time. The ambulance drivers were all on strike in Chicago, so all I got was a dog catcher who came to take me to the hospital. And every bump he hit, my leg just throbbed. So finally they got me to the hospital. They set my leg, which hurt like hell. Now, I could have played this up doing the victim card. I could have said, oh, man, I can't believe this happened to me. Well, I know I create my own reality by my experiences, so I decided, no, I'm not going to do that. So I decided to get the cast on there, teach my classes, and go on my way. So you don't have to be a victim. Anyway, as we go a little bit farther, we'll see that there are more things to understand about the ego and the image of separateness. So I think we're going to do another chapter on this. So this is good for now. See you in the next chapter. ¶¶